Welcome to Base by Base. Today we're exploring the intricate, often frustrating, world of rare diseases and the relentless hunt for answers. We're specifically looking at a really groundbreaking approach to diagnosing mitochondrial DNA diseases, you know, mtDNA diseases. These conditions, they're actually surprisingly prevalent, but historically they've been incredibly difficult to pinpoint. Okay, let's unpack this a bit. Our exploration today draws from a really impactful paper published just this year, 2025. It's titled Mitochondrial DNA Disease Discovery Through Evaluation of Genotype and Phenotype Data, the SolveRD Experience. It appeared in the American Journal of Human Genetics and was led by Dr. Thiloka Ratnaike and her colleagues. Our mission really is to understand how a new, quite clever workflow is changing the game for people with undiagnosed rare diseases. It's boosting diagnostic yields in a big way, even when, you know, a mitochondrial condition wasn't initially suspected at all.
Yeah, it's fascinating because diagnosing mtDNA diseases is traditionally so challenging.
Yeah.
Even with advanced next-generation sequencing, NGS, the bioinformatics pipelines, often just overlook the mitochondrial genome. They focus on the much larger nuclear genome.
Right, which seems like a critical blind spot, especially given how common these are collectively.
Exactly. It is a blind spot.
Yeah.
And these conditions, while individually rare, together they affect at least 1 in 4,300 people.
Yeah.
It's quite significant.
Yeah.
And in adults, most mitochondrial problems actually stem directly from the mtDNA itself.
Wow, 1 in 4,300. That's definitely more common than many might think for something labeled rare. So if they're that prevalent, why are they so hard to spot?
Well, a big part of it is the clinical presentation. It's incredibly varied. You can have rapidly progressive neurodegeneration in childhood, something like Leigh syndrome, or you might see much slower adult onset conditions like progressive external ophthalmoplegia.
Yeah.
And sometimes the symptoms even overlap with really common conditions like diabetes mellitus. What's fascinating here, and a great example, is the MTTL1 MET.3243AG variant. In some people, it shows up as maternally inherited diabetes and deafness, or MIDD, pretty specific. But other members of the same family might get severe mitochondrial encephalopathy, lactic acidosis, and stroke-like episodes.
Yeah.
That's MELAS. Completely different picture, same variant.
That level of variability, I mean, it sounds like a diagnostic nightmare. It's truly remarkable, but yeah, incredibly challenging to untangle.
It really is.
I can only imagine the diagnostic odysseys some families must have gone through trying to connect symptoms that seem totally unrelated. What other hurdles were making these conditions so tough to pin down?
So beyond that variability, there are other complexities. We often see variable penetrance.
Meaning not everyone with the variant gets sick or gets it as badly.
Exactly. Not everyone develops symptoms, or the severity can differ hugely.
Yeah.
Then there's a lack of validated blood biomarkers. Getting samples for family segregation studies can be tough too. And historically, there's been this issue with heteroplasmy levels in blood.
Ah, heteroplasmy. Can you just quickly unpack that term for us? It comes up a lot with mtDNA.
Of course. So think of heteroplasmy as a mix. Inside your cells, you have mitochondria, and each has its own DNA. Heteroplasmy means you have a mixture of normal mtDNA strands and mutated mtDNA strands coexisting in the same cell or the same tissue. The crucial part is the percentage of that mutated DNA. Higher levels often correlate with more severe symptoms or symptoms appearing at all.
Okay, so it's not just if you have the mutation, but how much of it you have and potentially where.
Precisely. And that proportion can vary between tissues. So a variant might be present at a low level in blood, maybe it's missed or dismissed.
Yeah.
But it could be at a much higher problematic level in, say, muscle or brain tissue.
Got it. Like having just a few bad ingredients might be okay, but a lot ruins the dish.
That's a good analogy, yeah.
Okay, so given all these challenges, how did Dr. Ratnaike and her team propose to tackle this? What was the breakthrough?
Well, they leveraged a major European research project called SolveRD. This is a huge initiative, really focused on finding molecular genetic diagnoses for people with undiagnosed rare diseases. Importantly, these were patients who'd already had exome or genome sequencing, but the results were inconclusive. So a really challenging group to start with.
Right. The diagnostic odyssey endpoint for many. And this is where their specific innovation comes in.
Yes. Dr. Ratnaike and her colleagues zeroed in on these unsolved cases.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where it gets really interesting. They didn't just, tweak an existing system slightly, they developed a powerful, semi-automated bioinformatic pipeline specifically designed to analyze mtDNA variants from that existing sequencing data.
Even if the data wasn't originally meant to capture mtDNA well, like from exome sequencing?
Exactly. They used established tools like mToolbox, which is known for mtDNA analysis, and integrated it with databases like MitoMap. And crucially, they incorporated their own MitoFen database. The key thing, as you said, is that this workflow was applied to this huge cohort where mitochondrial disease wasn't necessarily the primary suspicion. They cast a wide net.
Okay, so how did they actually build and test this thing? Walk us through the methods.
Sure. It was a careful, multi-step approach. First step, validation. They validated their bioinformatic pipeline using exome data from 42 individuals who were already solved, meaning they had confirmed mtDNA diagnoses.
Smart. Tested on cases where you already know the answer.
Precisely. It ensured the pipeline was accurate across different sequencing methods, and they set quality thresholds. They needed at least 50% assembly of the mitochondrial genome from the data and at least 5 times coverage depth for a sample to even be included.
Makes sense. Gotta have enough data to work with. What about the main study cohort? How big was that?
The main study was massive. They analyzed over 10,000 exome and genome data sets. These came from nearly 10,000 affected, undiagnosed individuals across various European reference networks, or ERNs.
Maybe quickly define exome and genome sequencing for folks.
Good idea. So exome sequencing mainly looks at the protein coding regions of your DNA. That's only about 1% of the total, but it's where most known disease-causing mutations lie. Genome sequencing, on the other hand, attempts to read your entire genetic blueprint, all 3 billion letters or so, including the non-coding regions. So yeah, they were reanalyzing this existing data, often exome data, which isn't designed to target the mitochondrial genome specifically.
That really is mining for gold in data that wasn't purpose-built for it. Okay, so they have this mound of data, they've set quality controls. How did they then sift through it to find potential disease-causing mtDNA variants?
Right, the prioritization step. They used mToolbox for this. They filtered for mtDNA variants that showed up with a heteroplasmy level of 1% or more. And importantly, they cross-referenced these variants with databases, MitoMap, and their own MitoFen, looking for variants already linked to disease. They also filtered out common haplogroup markers.
Haplogroup markers. Right. Those are like the common ancestral signatures, not usually disease culprits.
Exactly. Think of them like common spelling variations in the genetic text that tell you about population history, not necessarily about health issues. You need to filter those out so you're not chasing down common benign variations.
Got it. Okay. Now, the phenotype similarity scoring with MitoFen. This sounds really innovative, maybe the secret sauce. Tell us more about that.
It really is a key innovation. So they use the Human Phenotype Ontology, HPO. HPO is basically a standardized dictionary for clinical signs and symptoms. Mm-hmm. Instead of just writing, patient feels weak, a clinician assigns specific HPO terms like codes for muscle weakness or hearing impairment.
Ah, so it structures the clinical information in a computer-readable way.
Precisely. And their MitoFen database collects genotype-phenotype information from published literature, linking specific mtDNA variants to the HPO terms describing the symptoms they cause. This allowed them to compare the HPO terms listed for an undiagnosed patient in SolveRD against the known HPO profiles for different mtDNA diseases in MitoFen.
And generate a score based on how well they match.
Exactly. A phenotype similarity score. Higher score means the patient's symptoms look more like a known mtDNA disorder. To figure out the best score thresholds, they use a test cohort. This had 47 individuals with diagnosed mtDNA diseases and about 1,460 individuals with diagnoses linked to nuclear genes.
So they could see how well the score separated the two groups.
Yes. They use statistical methods like ROC analysis that stands for receiver operating characteristic. It helps measure how well a test, in this case the score, can discriminate between two groups. Think of it like tuning a radio dial to find the clearest signal. They were finding the score threshold that best separated mtDNA cases from others.
And what did they find? What was the optimal setting on that dial?
Well, they found a score of 0.48 gave a good balance. 94% sensitivity, meaning it caught 94% of the true mtDNA cases, and 65% specificity, meaning it correctly identified non-mtDNA cases 65% of the time. But crucially, they found a lower threshold, 0.3. achieved 100% sensitivity.
100%. So it caught all the known mtDNA cases in their test set.
It did. Now, the specificity at that level was lower, only 15%. That means it also flagged more potential false positives that weren't mtDNA cases. But for a screening approach in an undiagnosed cohort, that high sensitivity is exactly what you want. You want to make sure you don't miss potential candidates, even if it means manually reviewing a few extra cases later.
Right. Cast a wide net first, then sort through the catch carefully. Makes total sense.
Okay, so this sounds like a really powerful filtering system.
Yeah.
They applied this whole workflow, the quality control, the variant filtering, the phenotype scoring, to that big cohort of nearly 10,000 undiagnosed individuals. What were the results? Did it actually work? It absolutely did. The results were pretty striking. The workflow prioritized 136 milliAD DNA variants in 135 of those undiagnosed individuals. And after clinical review and confirmation, this led to confirmed or likely causative mtDNA disease diagnoses in 37 individuals.
37 diagnoses? In a group where these weren't initially suspected and previous sequencing hadn't found answers, that's huge for those families.
It really is. Across the whole SolveRD cohort of over 9,400 families, this translated to an additional diagnostic yield of 0.4%.
Okay, 0.4% might sound small in percentage terms, but let's pause on that. We're talking about patients who've often been searching for answers for years, even decades. Finding any diagnosis in this incredibly difficult to diagnose group is monumental. Finding 37 is, well, it's a testament to the approach. This wasn't just tweaking, it was finding hidden answers.
Absolutely. It highlights the value locked away in that existing genomic data. And the results further backed up their method. 34 out of those 37 diagnosed individuals, that's 92%, had a phenotype similarity score above that sensitive 0.3 threshold.
So the phenotype scoring really did help zero in on the right candidates.
It did. And they also found that the quality of the clinical information mattered.
You mean the HPO terms, having detailed descriptions.
Exactly. Having more HPO terms, and especially more specific HPO terms, terms that describe symptoms very precisely and are less common, was strongly linked to getting a diagnosis. It really underscores how vital detailed clinical phenotyping is. You need good clinical data to make the genomic data truly powerful.
Garbage in, garbage out, even with fancy tools.
Sort of, yeah. And another interesting detail, all the causative variants they found were present at blood heteroplasmy levels above 11%.
That's useful clinical information too. Okay, let's connect this to the bigger picture. What are the broader implications here?
Well, the study clearly demonstrates an efficient, large-scale way to reanalyze existing genomic data exomes and genomes, specifically looking for mtDNA diseases. And it works. It provides diagnoses in a diverse patient group where these conditions were previously missed. That 0.4% yield, as we discussed, might seem low compared to studies focusing only on patients already highly suspected of having mitochondrial disease, where yields can be much higher. But finding that 0.4% in a general undiagnosed rare disease cohort is actually quite significant and comparable to similar reanalysis efforts for other gene types. It shows the broad utility.
Right. It's finding cases outside the usual suspects list. And you mentioned earlier the pipeline helps deal with technical hurdles like NUMTs.
Yes, that's important. NUMTs, those nuclear mitochondrial DNA segments, the bits of mtDNA sequence that got copied into the nuclear genome over evolution.
The cookbook pages filed in the main library.
Exactly. They can look like real mtDNA variants in sequencing data if you're not careful, leading to false positives. The mToolbox pipeline they used has specific steps to help filter these out, improving accuracy. Plus, their quality control ensuring decent mtDNA coverage, even from off-target reads and exome data, was key to making this feasible on such a large scale.
So overall, it's a computationally efficient, largely automated way to boost diagnostic rates for these specific rare diseases. But it's not perfect, right? What are the limitations or areas for future work?
Definitely important to consider. No study is perfect. One key thing is the cohort ancestry. It was predominantly individuals of Eurasian genetic ancestry. So validation in more clinically and ethically diverse populations is really needed to ensure the findings and the pipeline's effectiveness hold up globally.
Good point. And standard practice confirming findings.
Yes, they strongly recommend external validation of any candidate variants found using alternative methods. That's just good genetic practice. Don't rely solely on one pipeline result. And the point about phenotypic data quality comes up again as a limitation, or rather a requirement.
Right, the HPO terms.
Yeah. Individuals with very limited or non-specific HPO terms just didn't benefit as much. It suggests we might need minimum data standards for future studies wanting to use this approach, maybe requiring, say, at least 5 HPO terms per patient to really leverage the phenotype scoring effectively.
So it's not quite a fully automated set it and forget it system then. Human expertise is still vital.
Absolutely not set it and forget it, especially for tricky cases like variants found at low heteroplasmy levels or patients with limited HPO data. Those still require careful multidisciplinary discussion. Expert clinical judgment looking at the whole picture remains absolutely essential. The pipeline is a powerful tool, but it's a tool to aid experts, not replace them.
That makes perfect sense. It leads to an interesting thought, though. As this pipeline gets used more widely, what else might we find? You mentioned something about potentially finding carriers who aren't obviously sick.
Yeah, this raises a really important question. The paper references previous data suggesting that maybe 1 in 250 people could be carrying a potentially pathogenic mtDNA variant at over 10% heteroplasmy, but without having, you know, a known significant neurological disorder.
Wow, 1 in 250, that's quite high.
It is. It emphasizes the potential for surprising discoveries using workflows like this. We might identify variants in people who don't fit the classic picture of mitochondrial disease. This could have implications for genetic counseling, reproductive choices, maybe future health monitoring, even if current symptoms are mild or absent.
That's a really fascinating and slightly complex area to think about. Okay, so let's try to summarize our exploration today. We've looked at how this new semi-automated workflow, cleverly combining mtDNA genotype analysis with intelligent phenotype similarity scoring, using HPO terms, is proving really effective at uncovering previously missed mitochondrial disease diagnoses from existing genomic data.
Yeah, finding answers hidden in plain sight, essentially.
Exactly. And this approach isn't just about the diagnosis itself, crucial as that is. It's about streamlining that diagnostic journey for patients and providing tailored information and counseling for individuals and families affected by these often devastating rare conditions. So what does this mean for you, our listener?
Well, this research represents a significant step forward. It shows how we can better leverage these huge genomic data sets we're generating to find concrete answers for patients stuck in diagnostic limbo. It really highlights the power of combining sophisticated computational tools with deep, detailed clinical information. It's turning data into diagnoses and potentially changing lives. It really is. And perhaps it leaves us with a provocative thought to consider. As we get better at finding these pathogenic variants, sometimes even in individuals who don't have obvious symptoms of a classic mitochondrial disorder, what are the ethical and clinical considerations around reporting these maybe unexpected secondary findings? And how might that ultimately shape our future approaches to genetic screening and counseling?
A really important question for the field moving forward.
This episode is based on an open access article under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License, CC BY 4.0. You'll find the DOI and a link to the license in the episode description.